So what these postulates give you is the version of quantum theory that's used in quantum information, where you have density matrices, where the density matrices can be acted upon by the positive trace non-increasing maps. So those are maps that includes unitary transformations, but it also includes, for example, projection transformations, and it also includes just general transformations that mix the state. And it's a finite dimensional systems. Okay, so here are the axioms, postulates. So I'll give each one a name. The first one, I'll write it down, and then I'll explain what it means. The system's having, or constrained to have, a given information carrying capacity. Have the same properties. Okay, so by information carrying capacity, I mean the maximum number of states that can be reliably distinguished. I'll explain what I mean by a constraint to have. So imagine you have a preparation device. For this system, you imagine that there are m states that can be reliably distinguished. M is the maximum number of states that can be reliably distinguished. So that means you have preparations. You have states p sub m, where m equals 1 up to big M. And there exists a measurement with outcomes labeled 1 through to m. And if you get the first outcome, it means you have the state p1, second one, state p2, and so on. And now what I mean by constrained to have is, imagine if you constrain your states so that they only ever give rise to a set of outcomes, to some subset of these outcomes. So for example, to some subset of n outcomes. Okay. So we choose preparations that only give rise to one of these outcomes. They never give rise to the ones that are excluded. Now, the states that we choose may be probabilistic in this set. So it may state one of the states that we consider may sometimes give this outcome, sometimes give this one. Okay. But we're constraining our state so that it has a given information carrying capacity. We're constraining the set of states now to a smaller set, only give rise. Is outcomes. So that's what I mean by constraining. And by have the same properties, well, associated with every system has associated with it a set of states, a set of measurements, and a set of transformations. Um, And what we mean by having the same properties is have the same sets. Okay. Any questions on that? Maybe worth thinking about examples of this. So we know this is true in quantum theory and also in classical probability theory. So in quantum theory, imagine, for example, you have a five-dimensional Hilbert space. Okay. You have a system that has a maximum of five distinguishable states. But you could constrain your system so that it only has support among three of those five states. And then your system would behave just like a system having dimension three. So if you constrain your system to belong to a subspace of dimension three in that five-dimensional Hilbert space, then it behaves just like a system dimension. It has the same properties as any other system. Same in the classical case, you may have something that has five distinguishable states. Let's say six, like a die. If you constrain it so that you only ever see three of those six, then again it behaves like a system only having information carrying capacity associated with three distinguishable states rather than six. And this is associated with, when we think about information, generally speaking, you don't care what system it is you use to carry your information. You just care that it has, you can take some information that's stored on one kind of system and transfer it to another kind of system, and you don't think that in so doing, you've changed anything as far as the information is concerned. So, for example, you can store your information on a hard drive, on a floppy disk. If you're in the 1980s, store it on any kind of thing. It's the same thing that's happening. Okay. Question two. This is what I talked about on Friday. Okay, the information carrying capacity, or the N for a composite system, is just given by the product, N's for each of the components. And we know this is true in the classical and in quantum. Atomographic locality. So remember, K is the number of probabilities you need to specify your state. And atomographic locality is the property that KAB is equal to KA times KB. A continuity postulate. So the continuity postulate is that there exists a continuous reversible transformation between any pair of pure states. For any given system. Okay. Let me explain what I mean by this. So first of all, what do I mean by a reversible transformation? So if I have a transformation here, T, then the transformation is reversible if there exists another transformation which has the effect that whatever state you send in, if you do this, you put that transmission in the reverse one, then whatever state you send in, you get the same state out. So this is just equivalent to having a. That's what a reversible transformation is. I told you what pure states are already. Pure states are states that cannot be written down as mixed states. So. And a mixed state is one that can be regarded as a mixed state is this where lambda, where it's non-trivial, so lambda is between 0 and 1. Not equal to 0, 1. And PA is not equal to PB. So that would be a mix. So that's a mixed state, and pure states are ones that are not like that. And geometrically, in the space of states, states on the any state where there exists any state, this state, where you can find two other states and mix them, so take a convex combination, get this state. Well, any state like this is not pure. It's mixed. States that are on the boundary, if there's a tangent, this state here is pure because there's no other states you can mix. If you have a bit of the boundary which is flat, then states in that part of the boundary are mixed. Because you can get to them by taking a convex mixture of other states in the boundary. By continuous, I mean that it's made up of, you can regard this as being made up of lots of small transformations that take you continuously through the space of states. I'll show you what I mean by that by examples. So if you have, in quantum theory, we know that the states, for example, for a qubit, are given by the block ball. If you're on the pure states are on the surface of the block ball, you can get from any one state to any other state in the surface of that block ball by going continuously through the pure states. If you have classical system, on the other hand, is a classical system where n equals 3. The pure states are now these states at the these three states here. If I want to go from this pure state to this one, well, there's no way to do it in a continuous reversible fashion, because if I perform a small, there's no small reversible transformation here, because reversible transformations have the property that they always take pure states to pure states. So if you're sitting on this pure state, then there's no pure states in the vicinity of this state that are pure as well. So there's no continuous reversible way of getting from there to here. Any questions?
So would this be a different definition of reversibility than like in quantum computing? Like, because if I can create like I guess like definitely entangled states, mm-hmm. and I can reverse that computation to leave with just pure states on the zeros. But that I think would be
yeah, it's the same thing, because entangled states can be pure. What's happening there is you've now got two systems coming in, and after this transformation reversible, they're entangled. You can now find the inverse of that transformation. So it's just the same transformation, but it's the same idea, but now applied to composite systems.
As long as I don't make any measurements or anything, then it's...
Yeah. And then the final postulate is one I don't like. Like all the other postulates, I think they're good. And this says basically that you take the simplest example that fits, the simplest theory that fits these other postulates. Write it down. The systems are described by the smallest number of probabilities consistent with the other postulates. So for each n, k should be as small as possible. Okay. Well, remember I showed you before that k is equal to n to the power r. I had to use a few additional topographic locality, information locality. I had to use a few other properties to get that, but those other properties follow from the first axiom. That's not completely obvious, but fairly straightforward. So the first postulate. So you can prove that k equals n to the power r. And now you're looking for the simplest case according to this that works. Well, you could try k equals n. But then you run foul of this continuity requirement, because this puts you in the classical theory. And you can't do that. You can't have continuous reversible transformations in pure states. So that means you have to go, so this doesn't work. You have to go to the k equals n squared case. And then that does work, because quantum theory is consistent with all of these properties, postulates. So that's not the end. What you have to do then is is to go through and use this postulates to construct quantum theory. So you need to construct the state space, the space of measurements, the space of transformations. And that's not straightforward. So I'm not going to attempt to do that in the lecture. But just a few words. So the way the proof works is, first of all, you consider the n equal to 2 case. Okay. And then you know from here that you have k equal to 4. One of those is associated with normalizations. Then you have 3 dimensions. And you need continuous reversible transformations. This is a group structure that gets you to a ball. There's only really one group that will do this. And so that gets you to the block ball. And then once you've got the block ball, you use that to construct the Hilbert space for the higher dimensions. Procedure for doing that. To construct the state space for the higher dimensions, consistent with the Hilbert space. Yeah.
In the last lecture, I think we showed if it is the classical theory, n should be n, a k should be n.
Yeah.
But is it also the other way in your arm is true? Like if k equals to n, it should be a classical theory.
Oh, okay. Yes. So first of all, think what n means. N is the maximum number of distinguishable states. Okay. And so if you allow arbitrary mixture of those states, if you're assuming you can take arbitrary mixtures of these states like this, then that completes you into this simplex, which gives you the classical theory. Good question. Okay. I've written down the postulates. Before I move on, are there any questions on this? Yeah. You had a question? Yeah.
Where is the evolution in the whole
Elizabeth? Okay. Once you've got the state space, so you get the state space, then you want to ask what evolutions are consistent with that state space, and then it's pretty standard, really, in quantum theory. There's only certain types of evolution, and those are the completely positive trace non-increasing maps. So that follows from that. And then a special case of that is unitary evolution, and unitary evolution is normally associated with quantum theory as the Schrodinger equation. It's just one special case. No more questions. So this work was from 2001. There's a lot of work in the meantime. People come in with different sets of axioms, including myself. I had another set of axioms. So if you're interested in this, look at those other ones as well. It was an interesting subject. A lot of people did work on it, but then it kind of stopped. And I think we still don't really have a completely compelling set of postulates. Nothing quite like the examples I started with on Friday, like nothing like Newton's laws or the postulates of special relativity. So my feeling is that is out there. My current intuition is that it has something to do with time symmetry, but a whole other story. Anyway, I think there's still something interesting to be found along those lines. Okay. So let me talk about the shape of quantum state space. So I could have finished, there's lots of different topics I could have used to finish this lecture, but I think this is kind of a fun topic and it gives you an intuition to what's happening in quantum theory to finish this course. So let's talk about this. So for quantum theory, k equals n squared. So k is the dimension of the state space, quantum states, n maximum number of reliably distinguishable states. The normalized states are, well, but then you take out one parameter, that's k minus 1. So n squared minus 1 is the dimension of the normalized state space. The boundary that's k minus 2. So just talking about the boundary. In quantum theory, the dimension of the pure states anyone know what the dimension of the pure states is? How many real numbers do you need to describe pure states in quantum theory? N-dimensional system.
It's just linear in the number of qubits, right?
Let's just say it's an n-dimensional system. So in that case, if he's talking about the number of qubits, n is equal to 2 to the power of however many qubits you have. But just I just want the answer in terms of n.
State, I think it can be mixed or read as a product, or like a tensor product state, so just n.
It is linear, yes, but it's not just n.
2 minus 1.
Say again, sir. 2n. I actually could put minus 2, because you have two things you want to take off. One, you want to impose a normalization condition, and then the other is you want to take off the overall phase. Okay, so just to unpack that, a pure state can be written like this. Any pure state can be written like that in some basis. And this provides you with, these are complex numbers, so you have 2n complex numbers. Okay, that's 2n. But then you need to subtract 1 because of the overall phase, and another 1 because we want to impose normalization. Okay. So a lot of our intuition comes from the special case n equal to 2, you know, a qubit. There's something bad about this special case if you're trying to get an intuition for the shape of state space. Let's see. So if n equals 2, k minus 2, which is the, well, let me just do all of it. So the that means k equals 4, k minus 1, which is the, I just did this here, actually. Let's do it here. So this one, k minus 1 equals 3. You can check my arithmetic. K minus 2 equals 2. So this is all consistent because we know that we have the block ball, and the boundary of the block ball has two dimensions in it. And then also, if we look at this here, we get. The pure dimension, that's 2n minus 2, is also 2. Okay. So in the case of the qubit, these two things are the same. Okay. So that isn't true usually. Let's take n equal to 3. Then we have k equal to 9 as the dimension of the state space. K minus one, the dimension of the normalized states is 8. Equals the dimension of the boundary is 7, but the dimension of the pure ones equals 2 times 3 minus 2, so 4. Okay, so in this case, these two things are different. And what that's telling us is that in the boundary, there's on the boundary of the state space, there's a lot of states which are not pure. So unlike the block ball, for the general case, most of the a generic state in the boundary, in fact, is not pure. You know, it's hard to get a very good intuition about this, but say a few things. So first of all, you might think, well, okay, we've got fewer. So here's an example of a state space that has a part of the boundary that's mixed and a part which is pure. Okay. But this is the wrong kind of picture for us, because we know there's a continuous reversible transformation between pure states. So it means you cannot have these kinds of edges here. You can't have a place where the pure states just stop. Okay. So this is wrong. It also doesn't quite fit anyway, because this has the same dimension for the boundary here, for the pure states, as for the boundary states. Whereas generically, a state in here has got to be mixed. Here's an example, and so here's just to try and get an idea of what kind of spaces have this property. So here's an example of a state space. I'll go on to the next board. Here's an example of a convex space, which has some of the right properties we want. Okay, I can't draw anything on the blackboard that's in 8 or 9 dimensions, but at least I can draw an example in 3 dimensions that has some of the right properties. In a previous version of this course, one of the students coined this as the Pringle state space. A Pringle space. So the idea is you take a, actually, just to give you a picture, because it's hard to draw even so, take a wire shaped in the shape of a circle, okay? Okay, and then take that circle and gently bend it, okay? So that the rim of that wire now is like the rim of a Pringle. You know what a Pringle is. It's hard to stop eating them. Okay. So I'm going to try and draw that, and it's. Not a very good effort, but that's my best attempt to draw Pringle. Okay, the Pringle, the edge of a Pringle. Okay. Now I want the states. The states on here are the pure ones. And then what you do is there's something called taking the convex hull. That's just where you take a set of pure states, set of extremal states in geometry, and you now find every state you can by mixing. What that does is it fills out the space into a solid. So I'm going to try and draw that. Every single. This is a terrible drawing now. Every combination you can. I'm going to stop there because it's get messy. I think you have the image. So you fill that out into a kind of solid here. So, and that's a space. And this space has the right kind of properties, you see, because now the dimension of the space, this it lives in three dimensions. The dimension of the boundary is 2, and the dimension of the extremal states is 1. It's not the right space, of course, but it at least gives you an idea of the kind of thing we're looking for. Okay, one more thing we can say about this situation is we can just see why, if you have n greater than or equal to 3, you have this effect of having states on the boundary that are mixed. So consider a density matrix, and I'm going to write it a general. This is a general density matrix. And any general density matrix, you can write it in diagonal form, okay, and in the basis of the eigenstates, and then I'll write it down like this. All I've done there is I've picked on one of the eigenstates, one of the projectors, and I pulled it out, and then everything else is still here. Okay. Now these lambdas, this lambda is positive. And if you imagine you're inside the state space, okay, and you start varying the lambda, okay, then that will move you in a straight line until you hit the place where lambda is equal to 0. Okay, and then you can't keep going if you want to stay in the space. So you hit a boundary. And when you hit that boundary, when lambda is equal to 0, then the state you have is this one here, okay, and this is in general this will be a mixed state. If there's a not equal to 0 for at least 2 of the entries, then this is a mixed state. If it's a qubit, then you only have one term here, then it would be a pure state. So in that case, the boundary states are pure, but in general, it's going to be a mixed state. Okay. Okay. We can also say any. So clear, yes. We can also say something more quantitative about the this spaces. So a condition, this is a condition for purity. If you want to understand the shape of the state space, then it's enough to understand where the pure states are. Because if you've got the pure states, you can complete the state space by taking the convex hull. Get all of the state space. Okay, so it's worth studying the pure states. And this is a condition for the states, the states to be pure. Okay, this is because this is only satisfied if you have projection operators onto of rank 1. So this is a condition. If you what you can do this condition is you can convert it into a condition on probabilities. Okay. So you can just take this kind of condition. So then you have to know the linear map between density matrices and this list of probabilities. That's something that's knowable. And then what this equation gives you is that the PKs are given by some quadratic function of the PKs. So each PK is given by a quadratic function. And then this, what you have is n squared quadratic equations. Because you have an equation for each of these entries. Okay. So that's one way to specify the state space, is to work out what those quadratic equations are, and then you complete the goal. But there's a, instead of using this, there's a simpler set of equations. Go over here. Okay, so this I'll give you some simpler conditions. This comes from work by Jones and Linden in 2004, and it was picked up on by it was just a sort of an incidental technical result in this paper used to prove something else. It was picked up on by Fuchs and collaborators in these papers on the archive. And the conditions are, well, first of all, that rho is Hermitian. That's a very simple condition to check. Okay, it's just about the entries row. And then you have two equations. Trace of rho squared is equal to 1, and trace of rho cubed is equal to 1. Okay. And then if that's true, then rho is pure. Okay. And there's a very simple proof, which comes from Fuchs, that this is true. So I'll give you the proof of that. So we have two equations. The first one, trace of rho squared equals 1. Before I move on, the important thing to note now is that we just have two equations. Whereas previously we had n squared quadratic equations. Now we just have two equations. One of them is quadratic, one of them is cubic. Okay, so the proof. If we write down rho in its eigenbasis, so then rho has eigenvalues lambda I, then we get these two equations. Okay. And the first equation tells us that this is true because we have a sum of positive numbers that add up to 1. So each of those numbers have each of the magnitudes of the lambdas has to be less than or equal to 1. So that has to be true. And now if we subtract these two equations, then we get this equation. And if you look at this, you can see that you have a sum of terms which have to be equal to zero, but each of these terms is greater than or equal to zero. So lambda squared is positive, but non-negative. And 1 minus lambda, we've just proven, is greater than or equal to zero. So the only way this can work is if each of the terms in here is zero. So that means that either one or the other, or both of these factors have to be equal to zero. Now we know from here or from here that at least one of them has to be equal to one. And then the rest, and then so we know at least one of these has to be equal to one. And let's say that's sorry, just a moment, I'm losing my train of thought here. You know, at least one of them has to be equal to one. Okay, so that could be any of them. I'm losing my train of thought. Okay, let's say that again. So these factors have to, at least one of these two factors have to be equal to zero every time. We know from here that at least one of these has to be non-zero. Otherwise, there's no way you can get this. Okay. So at least in one case, we have to have an entry which is non-zero for this. If so that's non-zero, then the other one has to be equal to one. So if this is non-zero, then this has to be zero. We get this zero here, which means that lambda I has to be one. Okay. So for at least one of the lambda i's, we have to have lambda I equals one. And it can only be equal to, if this is true, then that can only be true for one of the lambda i's. So that implies that we have lambda I equal to one that means we have a rank one projector, so we have a pure stick. So what we have now, if we look at this, we substitute in, like I did before, you can think of this in terms of the p's. What we have is a quadratic function. Of the p's is equal to one, and we have a cubic function and if we write down those equations, then the intersection of those two are the pure states. And it's interesting to contrast that with the classical case, like this. So in that case, you can write down two equations as well to pick out the pure states. So this equation picks out the first one, the linear equation, picks out the plane which the triangle is. Okay. And the second equation picks out a sphere, which has its origin at the origin, it has its center at the origin of the coordinate system. And then it cuts through these axes in the place where the pure states are. So these two equations get you the states, the pure states in the classical case. And so that just leaves a speculation. You know, what is there a hierarchy of theories? You know, this is just we have the classical case where you have a linear and a quadratic equation. We have the quantum case where we have a quadratic and a cubic equation. You know, is what's going on here? And of course, I don't know the answer to that, which is a good place to stop for the course. I just want to, there's a few regrets. There's actually lots of regrets, lots of subjects I didn't manage to cover. And if you're going to study quantum foundations more, here are some of the subjects I think are interesting. So the biggest and most significant omission is that I didn't look at quantum contextuality. Okay. It's a result going back to the 1960s due to Kokan and Specker that quantum theory is contextual in a certain sense. I don't have time to explain what that means. There's been a lot of work done on that in recent years, and it's even been connected to quantum computing, that this contextuality in quantum theory is somehow connected with the possibility of doing computing. It's what makes quantum computers work, according to some of the work that's been done. Second thing I didn't study was the PBR theorem. Fuzzi-Barrett Rudolph paper. That was the paper, a result where you show that that you must have psiontic interpretation. It did make a crucial assumption in it, and so there's still some possibility of finding papers which are not psiontic, but this was that paper. Third thing I didn't cover so there's an argument going back to Wigner a long time ago with Wigner's friend, so Wigner's friend is where Wigner has a friend who's inside a box. The guy makes a measurement, and Wigner is outside the box. He doesn't know what the friend saw, so he can speculate. With the friend, you know, from Wigner's point of view, the friend is in a superposition, having seen both outcomes. So there's been a lot of work done recently on extended Wigner's friend arguments, where you have not just one system but two systems and two friends making measurements. So Czaslaw Bruckner in Vienna has an argument like this, and Fauchinger and Renner also have an argument like this. The one by Fauchinger and Renner has received a lot of attention and discussed a tremendous amount. So that's very interesting. Okay. There's a toy model by Rob Speckens. And usually I get time to cover that, and there's a way of illustrating. Remember, I had the two cups. There's a way of illustrating it using four cups. So this is a toy model that shows you that it's a toy model that has a lot of the features of quantum theory. It's not the same as quantum theory, but it has a lot of the features of quantum theory, but it's epistemic, not ontic. There's an epistemic nature to the state. And then, I mean, there's many more things I should discuss, but one more I think I want to put on this, I should have discussed. One more thing to put on this list is weak measurements. This is work by Aharonov and his collaborators, and it's very interesting and different perhaps in flavor to a lot of the stuff I've covered. Okay, so that's it. That's the end of the course. Any questions? Everything has been answered. You understand quantum theory. So my work here is done.
Can I ask why extended with your friend?
Yes. Okay. So I mean, we would take a lecture to explain it, but let me try to give you a rough idea. So you have now an entangled system, and you have a friend makes a measurement on this one, and a friend makes a measurement on this one. Okay. And then you have Wigner, who's sort of omnipresent, just looking at this from the outside. And then Wigner has the choice to either to leave the friend as is and look and see what the friend, each friend, look and see what outcome the friend got, or to re-interfere a friend. Well, this is difficult because it's a macroscopic being and someone who perhaps is a friend as well. But to recombine them so they effectively forget what outcome they saw because you get re-interference. Okay. And then these arguments look at those results. And it turns out if you want to believe that those things the friends saw, even when they were re-interfered, they later forgot, if you want to believe those things really happened, then you get an inconsistency with quantum theory. You can't do a measurement to show that inconsistency. The things you suppose must have happened are inconsistent. So the title of the paper by Fauchinger and Renner is something like quantum theory cannot consistently describe itself. So it's very interesting, and it goes quite a long way beyond what Wigner originally did. Once you introduce entanglement, then the real quantum magic. Any other questions? One of the things that's been interesting about this is that every interpretation has to respond to this. The proponents of every interpretation out there have to say how they get around the Wigner friend argument. And so that's why there's been a tremendous amount of debate in the literature. As people say how it is they used to escape.
Could you recommend any references for studying Wigner's friend?
For what one, sorry?
Studying Wigner's friend.
I mean, if you search on Wigner's friend, I don't know them, obviously. But if you search on Google Scholar, the Wigner's friend and Bruckner or Renner. I can't remember how to spell his collaborator's name, Fauchinger. Fauchinger and Renner. Then you'll come across those. Also, they've Renner. Pretty sure Renner has given a talk on this at Perimeter. Somebody's given a talk on this at Perimeter. It might be Lydia Del Rio. Has given a talk on this. So if you go to Persa, you'll find a nice talk on this. I hope I'm right there. Yeah, a lot of these things, this talks on process. So if you like watching talks instead of reading papers, I find pretty much everything there. The PBR theorem. So Matt Pusey gave a lecture in this series in the 2015-16 version of this course, and his lecture is the penultimate lecture, lecture 14 in that course. We'll find out about that there. He's a good speaker, so that's worth looking at. Speckens toy model. I've lectured on this in previous versions of this course, at the 2015-16 version. I lectured on this. I can't remember the lecture number. It would have been about 11. And weak measurements. I haven't given any lectures on that, but we've had Popescu has visited here and given talks. Aharonov has given talks on this on PERSA. Find those on PERSA or on the archive.